So Happy New Year, as if though nobody said that yet, right? We've got 2 weeks left in this particular study. We're going to be in the book of John tonight and next week as well as we look at the last two miracles of, like I said, this study, not necessarily the last two miracles of Jesus' life, but we've been looking at lessons that we can garner from miracles that Jesus himself performed during his public ministry. Tonight, we're going to be in John chapter 9 eventually. I'm not going to do a lot of review. I think we already pretty much know the purpose of and all that kind of stuff. We've talked about it enough, other than I'm going to ask you one question, which I know that you already know how to answer. What is the purpose of miracles? Confirm the word, confirm the speaker, right? We know that. We've talked about it each particular week. And tonight's no different. But we're going to look in John tonight. And perhaps you don't remember necessarily all the way back to the first lesson in this particular series, but the first miracle that we looked at was the wedding feast miracle in Cana. It took place in Judea. It was a miracle that was recorded for us only in John. Last week, we looked at feeding the 5,000, a miracle that was the only miracle, as a matter of fact, that's recorded for us in all four Gospels. And tonight, we're going to look again at John, and next week also a miracle, John. So if I ask you what was the purpose of the Gospel of John, what would the answer be? How about this? The purpose of the Gospel of John is to confirm Jesus as God's Son. John gives us 7 miracles in the course of his book. 6 of those 7 are only talked about in the book of John, exclusive to the book of John. So we'll be looking tonight, as we started the class, the series a few weeks ago, and next week, at a miracle from the book of John. John uses a particular word in his gospel to refer to miracles. Do you know what it is? You do know what it is. Tracy knows what it is. He says the word signs. Yep, he uses the word signs. We had 5 different words when we first started the class. We talked about sign or signs was one of those words. It's a word that John just kind of, commandeered to use in his particular gospel about proving who Jesus was through these signs, through these miracles. Now, I've said before, by the way, and you may notice on the screen, I've got 36 miracles recorded in the Gospels. And how many miracles have I told you that we've got record of before tonight? Does anybody remember? Does anybody recognize that I've changed the number? I talked about 37. For some reason, I went back this week and I counted the number of miracles. I've got 37 all through my notes, and I messed it up. I was a false teacher. There's only 36 performed during his public ministry. And like I just got through saying, I think I just got through saying, 7 of them are recorded in the book of John. And then of those 7 miracles, 6 of them are exclusive to John's gospel. Back to the word signs. John used this word. The other gospel writers used the word sign, but not to refer to Jesus' miracles. Okay? Now, hear me now and listen to me later, or whichever it was, way it was that they said it. I did not say that the others didn't use the word sign. I said that when they used that word, it was not used to refer to a miracle. John is the only one that does that. 17 times in the book he does that. One more thing about John's gospel before we kind of get into the miracles part of it. John's gospel does not have any parables in it. But the gospel or the miracles that John talks about can be used almost in a parabolic sense. And this one is tonight especially that we're going to look at. You remember the story. We'll read it in a few minutes. Jesus used mud to put on the eyes of the man who was born blind. And in doing so, caused him to go somewhere else in order to get that mud washed off and sight restored. And that created a whole long, drawn-out process that started off with a day with a guy just getting his sight restored, ended up in front of the Pharisees, in front of the council. And so as Jesus did this on this particular day, the conversation ends later with the blind man and Jesus and some Pharisees talking about the difference between physical blindness and spiritual blindness. And that's where we're going with this tonight. Jesus is talking about, he's healing a blind man, but he's saying physical sight, physical blindness is not an issue. Spiritual blindness is. And that's the application we want to make in the lesson tonight to what we're looking at. Context. Let's talk about context of where we're trying to go with this. That very first miracle that we looked at all those weeks ago, the wedding feast in Cana, took place in Judea. And it was shortly after that miracle that Jesus went to Galilee to get away from the Pharisees. At least that's probably the best reason. To get a little space put between him and the Pharisees to be able to preach and to teach and to do things that he needed to do during his public ministry without so much interference. But we know the rest of the story, right? We know that eventually he goes back. And we know that he has to go back. He has to fulfill the things that are prophesied. And so he's in Galilee, but he's getting ready to go back. And this miracle that we look at tonight takes place in Judea, okay, or in Jerusalem specifically. So he's getting ready to come back. There is discussion with him and his brothers regarding this. We'll get to that in just a second. But I want to kind of backtrack for just a little bit and go back to the start of John, the Gospel of John, and that purpose that John wrote this book in order to prove to the reader that Jesus was Christ, the Son of God. We had one of our lectureship speakers, and I can't remember who it was right this minute, but he talked about the issue of Gnosticism that came about full-fledged in the second century. The book of 1 John may be written to battle that Gnosticism, even though it was written not in the second century, but at the end of the first century or towards the end of the first century. The Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and Revelation, all written late. The Gospel of John not being written like the other three Gospels. What do we call the other three Gospels, by the way? There's a name for them. Synoptic Gospels, because they summarize. They give us a synopsis of. What do they cover? Birth, human lineage, childhood events, briefly, all of Jesus' life. John doesn't go there. John starts in chapter 2, or in chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word was God, and the Word was with God. He jumps to chapter 2, and we've got John the Baptist witnessing, making an account, proclaiming Jesus Christ, the Son of God, one whose sandals he is not worthy to unloosen. John just jumps straight in on the God part, making the point. It's likely that John wrote the Gospel of John also to deal with some of these issues that were impacting the church of the first century. Issues that were important, issues that were causing them to backslide, issues that could have broken the church down if allowed to continue. You got your Bibles? I hope you do tonight. Let's go to John chapter 2. Kind of doubling down on this purpose of the book of John and the purpose of miracles. John chapter 2, verse 11. The beginning of signs Jesus did in Galilee. And then what does it say the purpose of that was? Or what was, it doesn't say the purpose of it is, it gives us what the purpose is, that his disciples believed in him. The very first miracle that Jesus performed. John tells us it was the first miracle. And what was the result of it? Those that followed Jesus saw it, and they believed in who he was. They believed he was the Son of God. Turn your Bible, staying in John chapter 20. Go to verse 30 and 31. And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. That's what John's about. That's what this series is about. If miracles are to confirm the word and we've been studying them, then that's what we're trying to do, to confirm that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Who has faith in him? Them? How about us? Has faith in him. And so as we finish this out, we're going to go through these next two miracles that also are at the end of Jesus' public ministry. He spent a couple of years in Galilee, and now he's back in Judea. We're close to the end of his ministry. And these two miracles are in that phase. Hold your finger in John, or actually don't hold your finger in chapter 20. Put your finger in chapter 7. Hold that. Put a ribbon there in chapter 7. We're going to come back to 7, and then we'll go to 9 to spend the rest of the night in chapter 9. But in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, Jesus is getting ready to go back to Jerusalem. And there's a phrase there that Luke uses that says he steadfastly set his face to return to Jerusalem. What does that mean? If you steadfastly set your face. Some of you guys probably know the look, right? We've all got the look from our wives or girlfriends or whoever at one time or another, right? Some people call it the side eye. We've gotten that steadfast look because the person who gave us that look was resolving to do something about something. Jesus steadfastly set his face. Nothing was going to go between Jesus and Jerusalem. He knew where the future was going. He knew what he had to do. And he was going there. He went there. Luke says he steadfastly set his face to go there. There was resolve with Jesus in this particular circumstance. Go to John chapter 7. Again, with context, there's always a little bit of drama, right, within a family. John chapter 7, starting with verse 2. Now the Jews' feast of the tabernacles was at hand. His brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Now, I read that as benignly as I possibly could. What's happening here in this conversation? Jesus and his brothers are not getting along about this issue. I want to go back and read it again, and I'm going to try to put a little different tone in it. I may not be successful at it. I'm going to try. His brothers said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea. That way your disciples may also see all these works that you are doing. For nobody does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be famous." If you do these things, show yourself. Well, what does the next verse say? For even his brothers did not believe who he was. We don't think about that a lot. I think we should think about it more. There was a lot of conflict here. Jesus did this thing that a lot of people didn't understand. We talk about the disciples not understanding everything. Jesus' own flesh and blood family didn't understand. And so he's getting ready to go back to Jerusalem, and his brothers are chiding him about this. Go, you need to get out of here. Go. If you're really who you say you are, get down there and prove it. Jesus responds, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you. It hates me because I testify that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I'm not yet going, for my time has not come." And when he said these things, he remained in Galilee. Hesitate for just a second, but what does it say in verse 10? But when his brothers had gone up, he went also, not openly, but as it were in secret. Jesus knows what he has to do. He knows what must be done. So he heads back into the lion's mouth, so to speak, to do a few things and still do some preaching and try to get to that point where God's will is fulfilled, where Jesus' will is fulfilled, where all the prophecies come together. Who'd he do it for? Well, he did it for us, right? And we need to think about that as we're looking at this miracle tonight that we're trying to get some lessons from. Chapter 9, the miracle. We're going to try to read this whole chapter. I think we've got time to do it. Make some comments about each section as we read it. Chapter 9, verse 1 through 3. Jesus is in Jerusalem. He's been in the temple. He's walking around, okay? As Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered and said, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." Look at the order of things. What did Jesus see before his disciples? Jesus saw a soul that needed to be saved, right? And then there was a question asked. Do you remember back in school that perhaps you had a teacher that you really wanted to impress? And you would think of a question to ask that teacher to let that teacher know how much you were into the class, maybe how smart you were, how deep you were trying to take the subject. I don't know if that's what happened here or not. It doesn't really tell us why they asked the question. Was it a common belief that sin created problems like this? It was. They probably heard in school over and over and over again, there is no death without sin, there is no suffering without iniquity. Maybe they truly believed that and were just asking just the first thing that popped into their head. Either way, they were talking about this man as if though he were a theological point to be made. What did Jesus say? He didn't sin, nor did his parents sin. But the works of God may be revealed through him. I want to be careful with that part. Because if you read that just on a topwater level, you're going to say, Richard, did God cause him to be born blind so that he could make an example out of him? This doesn't say that. This says that there is an opportunity here. We all run across opportunities every day. What can we do to glorify God when we run across those opportunities? And that's the lesson that Jesus is trying to teach to his disciples. You know, you may be asking who sinned, this man or his parents. By the way, does that sound a lot like Job's friends? When they came to see Job, everything was because they sinned, because Job sinned. But there is an opportunity here. You've heard the saying that every cloud has a silver lining, right? Do you believe it? Aren't there opportunities everywhere we go? Everywhere we see something, there's an opportunity to glorify God. You know, one of the things that my boys absolutely could not stand was when I would be just driving down the road and I see something happen and I'd launch into a Bible lesson about that, whatever it was that I saw. Dad, please. Oh, guys, you know, give me a break here. I'm trying to do the dad thing. Make a point. That's all Jesus was doing. He ran across an opportunity. The man's physically blind. Jesus says, I can make a lesson out of this, and we can talk about spiritual blindness. And that's what they did. Jesus' disciples saw a theological case study in these verses. Jesus saw something different. Verse 4. I must work the works of Him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. And so right off the bat, Jesus contrasts light and dark, sight and blindness. Stand by, guys, while I teach you a lesson here and prove to you something with this man. And by the way, I'm not going to be here a whole lot longer. You need to be paying attention to what it is that I'm doing. What did Jesus know that his disciples truly did not understand completely at this point? There was a time, and he was going to die for them. He was going to the cross on their behalf, on our behalf. If Jesus' disciples saw a blind man that they wanted to make into a theological case study, what did Jesus see? Jesus saw a blind man with a soul. Verse 5 through 7, I think. As long as I am in this world, I am the light of the world. This is Jesus still talking. When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and he made clay with the saliva and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with clay. And he said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, parentheses open, which is translated sent, parentheses closed. So he went and he washed and he came back seeing. Jesus saw a man that needed to be healed. What were the problems here? First, right off the bat, what was the problem that everybody sees? He can't see, right? He's blind. What else do we know about this man? At this particular moment, he's physically blind. At this particular moment, he's also spiritually blind. And we learn that as we read the rest of this. Jesus has said in the... Turn back to chapter 8 real quick. Look at verse 12. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but in light. And he's repeating the same thing here, right? I am the light, guys. I have something. The world needs it. This man needs it. What do you know about the pool of Siloam, by the way? It has Old Testament significance.
Had troubled waters. If you walked into troubled waters, it would take care of the problem.
There were... No, that was the pool of Bethesda. Wasn't it? I wasn't even thinking about that. I'll come back... We'll talk about that later. The Pool of Siloam was from an aqueduct, a tunnel that came underneath the city, underneath the walls. Do you remember in the lectureship two times ago, Dr. Manner, the archaeologist, the professor from Harding, who talked about some of these things, and he had showed us a picture of him standing in this tunnel. Do you remember when that tunnel was built, by the way? Hezekiah built this tunnel. Hezekiah directed this water under the walls of the city of Jerusalem and into a pool that was in the southeast portion of the city. It means sent. The water was sent down an aqueduct. Why did Jesus tell the man to go do something like that? By the way, we think this man was probably somewhere around the temple. In Acts chapter 3, there's a reference to the court of women, and archaeology has shown us that it's a place where has shown us that it's a place where a lot of the begging was done because of the proximity just to the temple and the city itself, where it was. If that's where he was quite a way away from this pool of Siloam. Why do you think he did it?
To prove
he was who he was? He could have spoken it into. He didn't. He decided to use spit, dirt, mud, all that kind of stuff. And if I tell you the answer is, I don't have a clue. Maybe that's just what he wanted to do at that particular moment. But what do we learn from it, by the way, when we're looking at this? Jesus can do as Jesus wishes to do. Jesus put together a plan for this particular man that caused what? A buy-in from this particular man. And when he got up and went and washed, he took the first step towards the definition of his faith. Jesus put that spit into the dirt, rubbed it in his eyes. Think about what he might have thought for just a minute. He's sitting there. He starts off the day. It's a normal day. He's doing his begging. Some people walk by. He hears a conversation that involves him. Maybe he rolled his eyes. And he said to himself, you know, everybody that walks by here asks that same question. What did I do to sin? What did my parents do to sin? They didn't do anything. Why won't anybody get it? And they talk about him as if though he's not even there. And then all of a sudden he feels warm mud on his eyes. And he said, well, this is different. I wonder what's happening with this. And then Jesus says, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. What does Scripture say, by the way? And he got up and he went. And then it says real quickly, and he came back seeing. The understatement of the whole thing. That's it. He went, he came back seeing. Did he say, Jesus, there's probably some water closer than that. There's a hose bib over there that they fill the trough where they feed the camel or give the animals drink. And he didn't say anything. He got up, he went. He recognized that there was something different about Jesus. And he got there and then came back seeing. Jesus saw a person to be healed. Can I also put in there, and I should have done this when I made this slide, a person to be saved? He saw a man with a soul. He saw a person to be healed, a person to be saved. Verse 8. Therefore, the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, is this not he who sat and begged? And some said, yes, this is he. And others said, he is like him. And he said, and I picture this part with a little bit of frustration. He says, I am he. Guys, I am he. You know me. I'm the same guy that was here this morning without sight. Therefore they said to him, how were your eyes opened? And he answered and said, a man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes. And he said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and I received sight. Then they said to him, where is he? And he said, I don't know. And they brought him formerly, he who was formerly blind, to the Pharisees. And now it was a Sabbath when Jesus had made the clay and open his eyes. And if this were a Far Side cartoon, the caption would be "Trouble Brewing" at this particular point. So, where do you go when you've been blind all your life? He went back home. He no longer had a job. His job was begging. He had a workstation for that. Probably didn't feel right about going back there. He was no longer blind. And he goes home. Have you stopped and wondered how he found home, by the way? I have. I don't have an answer for that either. Somebody showed him. Do what?
He closed his eyes.
Yeah. He closed his eyes and felt his way back home. You know, that's something else about going to the Pool of Siloam. It couldn't have been easy for him to get there. He didn't know where the Pool of Siloam was. He could get from home to the temple and back, probably. The Pool of Siloam is in the southeast part of the city. Somebody had to take him, or he had to find his way there, crawl his way there by asking and running into things. At any rate, he went home and his neighbors didn't recognize him. And they said, "Who are you?" And he says, "Well, it's me, same old guy that I've been." And the answers didn't sink. The people couldn't understand it. And then they did probably either the best thing or the worst thing they could have done. Either one, you take your pick. Where did they decide to go with him? To the council. Take him before the Jewish leaders. You know, somebody's got to answer this question for us. We don't understand it. He said it was this man named Jesus. We find out as we read on down a little bit, and I guess it's a spoiler alert kind of thing, but his parents are going to be upset about this and worry about something being put out of the synagogue. And we know that because John tells us that the council had already decreed anybody that talks about Jesus, that believes in Jesus, will be put out of the synagogue. In other words, you take them to the back and just shoo them out the door? No. Think of it in terms of withdrawn from. Think of it in terms of, or even excommunicated, to use a denominational term. That's what was going to happen to someone who professed a belief in Jesus. Not just scolded, kicked out. I'll come back to that in just a little bit. Have I started verse 15 yet? Have I read it? We need to do that. All right. Then the Pharisees also asked him again, how had he received his sight? And he said, he put clay on my eyes and I washed and I see. Therefore some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. And others says, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was division amongst them. And they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him who opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. The interrogation continues. Even though the man who was formerly blind didn't know exactly who Jesus was, what did he come to the conclusion of? That he was a prophet. He recognized something was different, something was special. Satan is always looking for an angle of attack. I guess I better speed up. Verse 18. But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents and they asked, is this your son whom you say was born blind? Two questions, real quick. Back to back, how did they respond to those questions? Yes, this is our son. Yes, we know he's born blind. He's our son. He told you the truth about this. Responded as parents would. There's a third question. Probably they anticipated that third question. How does he now see? We don't know. You need to ask him. He is of age. That probably meant, by the way, that he was about 30 or more. We don't know. Why don't you know? Well, this is the part that I gave the spoiler alert for earlier. What had the Jews decreed? Anyone who believes in Jesus, anyone who professes that Jesus is God's son, out And so they asked the parents, and the parents, of course, punted back to the son. Verse 24 through 34, I'm not going to read for time's sake, but it's a second interrogation. And so he talks about this, and I want us to look down about halfway through that. The second time they ask, he says, I told you already and you did not listen. Then they reviled him and said, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses, but for this fellow, we don't know who he is from or where he is from. And the man says, you don't? We know that God doesn't hear sinners. And yet God heard this man. He must not be a sinner. Do you want to also be his disciples? Oh, and you know, there's a point in every argument where you decide, I've got to stand my ground. I've got to do what I've got to do. It's that fish or cut bait moment, right? And he makes that decision. He says, I'm standing with God. I know what happened. And they also make a decision. They make a decision right then, I believe, that they're going to take him out of the synagogue. They don't want this particular thing being talked about. You know, they had a premise. Anyone who breaks the Sabbath traditions is a sinner. Jesus has broken the Sabbath traditions, therefore he must be a sinner. If he's a sinner, he cannot be from God. What was the man's premise? God obviously does not hear sinners. God obviously heard this man. Nothing that can be done like this can be done except through God. The man even talked about, since the beginning of time, no one has ever healed sight, healed the blind. And yet this man did. What was the conclusion that he drew? They had their premises wrong, right? Correct? Yeah. Three verses left in this. I'm hurrying. We get to the end. And the Jews have followed Jesus out of the temple. Jesus has found the man. They've talked about it. Jesus asked him, do you know who you're talking to? And I am he who healed you. And in verse 38, he says, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. When he put everything together, that faith journey that started when he first got healed comes full circle. And when he realizes who it is that's standing before him, that he didn't see before, he immediately worships. I think sometimes we think of worship as being something that we are commanded to do and therefore we just have to do it. What did this man do without being commanded to do? Bear with me. I'll wrap it up in 3 minutes. He worshiped. You know, a lot of times when we come on Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, Wednesday nights, whenever, the world has crashed in around us. We've got a lot of things on our mind. But we're like this man right here. We're in the presence of Jesus. Do we want to spontaneously worship like this man did because he realized who he was with? Or do we have to kind of get in the mood because somebody got in our way and ran a red light and slowed us down on the way here, or our football team lost the game the day before, or whatever the case might be? And we come and we're here to worship, and sometimes we don't act like we're here to worship. This man did act like he wanted to worship. He understood what had happened and he gave thanks for it. Last three verses, real quick, there's a word play going on with Jesus and his disciples, and I have not kept up with my points to be made up here. I'll just go ahead and put them all on the board. And Jesus talks about physical blindness and spiritual blindness, and the Pharisees are there and they say, oh, you're talking to us? As if though you're teaching us this? And Jesus says, yeah, I am talking to you. And he makes the point through a play on words that physical blindness can be healed. Spiritual blindness, if you persist in it, you don't have a chance. And so as he goes through this miracle with this man who received his sight back, who probably at some point along the process wondered, why did I get my sight back? All of a sudden I can see, but I've got a lot more problems, because he was put out of the synagogue. Yet through all of this, his faith grew stronger and stronger. When we're faced with difficult problems within this world, does our faith get stronger and stronger? James says it should. James chapter 1, verse 2 and 3 says exactly that. You've been patient with me. I didn't finish when I should have. I'm not going to say questions or comments. I'll try to give you your 3 minutes back next week, okay?